The people's power grab. So remember when Mitch McConnell was upset about that very first bill at the House, and he said, it's a power grab for the people.
What a terrible thing.
I know. So I figured, why not? If we're going to talk about voter registration and mobilization, I'll just take his lead.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. It was good to get the chance to catch up with Tatenda Musapatiki. Tatenda is a new media professional who is currently Senior Director of Campaigns at Acronym, a digital organization committed to winning elections and building digital infrastructure for the progressive movement. Tatenda has experience managing digital programs and has worked on growing online communities and doing project management for advocacy organizations. She spent time at NGP Van helping sell political software, at the new media firm working on online ad buys, in the political ads part of Facebook, and is now building a program in the area of voter registration for Acronym, which she is calling People's Power Grab. If you care about how to use digital ads to register progressive voters, you'll want to be aware of what Tatenda is up to. So, a quick word from our sponsor, then my interview with Tatenda Musapatiki at Acronym.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Tatenda.
Hi.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Tatenda Musapatiki. I am currently the Senior Director of Campaigns at Acronym. I got started in the digital space about 10 years ago, knowing that I really was interested in communication and how you can talk to people online about things that matter.
You mentioned you've been in the digital space, which, without context, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of different things online. I think that's generally what digital is in politics. It's taking traditional tactics and putting them where people are, which more and more tends to be online. So I have worked at software companies. I have done social media strategy. I've dabbled in some email in my time. But for probably the last 5 or so years, I've really focused on digital advertising, which I think is a sector in the space that's getting a lot more attention these past few years.
Definitely. So let's just talk a little bit about how you went down this road a little bit. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? What sort of your background before you enter the workforce?
So I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia. Both of my parents are from Zimbabwe, which is a small country just north of South Africa. So I think that's provided a lot of context for my life and approach. I've always really been civically engaged, I guess, paying attention, just because I think my parents have always been really aware of what's happening, not just in this country, but in our home country as well. So that's something that's always been a conversation topic for us. I went to college at Davidson, North Carolina. I loved it a lot. I'm proud to say we have a lot of Davidson alumna, especially in DC, just killing it, which is really exciting to see. And then I actually fell into this line of work because of Republicans, which is funny enough. So when I was at Davidson, they have a program called Davidson in Washington, which I did, which required you to get an internship. And I could not find one for the life of me in North Carolina. And so I just reached out to people who knew people through listservs in our career, I guess, organization at Davidson. I forget what they call it. And so I got connected with a woman at the Chamber of Commerce. And I was like, I need an internship. I don't care what it is. And so I ended up working in their, I guess, grassroots effort within the large Chamber of Commerce and learned so much in that role. Number one being I am a Democrat.
What sort of quote-unquote grassroots efforts were they working on?
So there was a network of local chambers of commerce that they wanted connected in some way to what was happening at this national chamber level. So I worked a lot on this website hub that they developed to get local or state chambers of commerce enrolled in this portal so that they could easily interact, I guess, with each other and national chambers of commerce. And I thought it was really cool. I talked to so many chambers of commerce across the country to talk to them about the importance of being online and connecting with the national and how they could help their local efforts, which I think local chambers of commerce are really great. I learned a lot about how they help local business and how, you know, in different localities, the needs were very different. I ended up having long conversations with these folks because I'm chatty and I needed stuff to do.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, where I really learned the what online work could be and what grassroots work is. It's not just what's happening at the national, because I fundamentally really disagreed with everything I was hearing at the national level, especially in terms of unions and workers and how they approached workers' compensation and organizing. I thought it was really just backwards. So I really wanted my next internship or roles in DC to have that online component and talk to people online. And then the economy crashed. So I was just like, I'm going to go to grad school and just intern while I'm in grad school, which then turned into working full time while I was in grad school.
Well, and where were you working full time when you were in grad school?
I was at NGP Van, where I met you.
Oh, I didn't know that was exactly when it was, but
yeah,
I remember you from then, of course.
Yes, I was in grad school full time and working as a sales coordinator, where, again, I learned a lot about just companies and how software can influence politics and how it makes things easier, or some people may argue harder, but I think easier at the end of the day.
So how bad was that NGP Van experience?
It was delightful. It was, I feel like I met my best friends there. I met some incredible mentors who've really influenced my career and helped shape my career in a way that I don't even know if I could fully express all the gratitude for that. I also learned some fundamental skills that have served me throughout the rest of my career. I thought I'd never do sales again, and I ended up selling stuff at Facebook. I learned a lot about how to communicate with different departments. So what salespeople need is different from what finance people need, which is different from how engineers communicate with anybody. And so figuring out how to communicate effectively across those different departments is also a really critical skill I think I learned there.
And you got a chance to walk around in the woods with me in Vermont once, I remember.
I cried. I hate nature. It was dark. It was awful.
We had fun.
You had fun. I had fun when we got back.
What caused you to leave NGP Van and go on to the next thing, and what was it?
I needed a bigger challenge. I was at a place where I did not want to sell things.
Because you were part of the sales team there.
Yes,
and definitely, on the sales team, you have to try to sell things.
Yeah, I didn't want to sell things. Like, I didn't want to do any kind of learning of code whatsoever. And so what I knew I wanted to do was figure out more of like the comms or digital, like the folks who wrote the emails and wrote the social media. I wanted to kind of be a part of that world. So I went to a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
It was called Americans for Tax Fairness. I think it's still in existence.
And what was the mission of Americans for Tax Fairness?
To act as the anti-Grover Norquist. So to kind of have the both policy and then also, I guess, field. So for us, we were more targeted on field than direct lobbying. But to have that same kind of influence over tax policy, but from the left's perspective.
So it was more about progressive taxation and sufficient taxation than it
yes.
was about riling people up to
everyone
not be
needs
taxed
to pay their fair share.
Yeah.
I think is the one line I will take from that.
How long were you there?
4 months.
And so that sounds like it wasn't where you wanted to be if you
no.
were there that long.
No, it wasn't great.
Okay. So we'll skip right along too.
Great.
What was next for you?
I went to a small consulting firm, a boutique consulting firm, which provided a lot of learnings.
What was this consulting firm?
I'm not going to name it because I feel like it's important to talk honestly about what happened there.
Okay.
And so while I was there, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, one, how consultants work, which was something where I knew you could consult, but what was that work? What did it mean? Because it was bipartisan, I learned a lot about how Republicans operate, which was something I hadn't had much exposure to except for at the Chamber of Commerce, but this was different.
Uh-huh. Well, when you say consulting firm, what kind of consulting were they doing?
Digital consulting.
Okay.
So I did a lot of work on doing social media audits. I wrote some emails for folks thinking about advertising plans. Mm-hmm. And then I learned I'm really good at project managing stuff. So I Project managed a lot of website builds, mm-hmm. some app builds. I ended up running a lot of the content development across projects and across clients, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot, but I also learned that like I'm not a consultancy kind of person. I don't think that in rigid bureaucracies I'm able to thrive. I ended up getting fired from that organization. It didn't work well, but I think it's important to talk about failures and where you think you failed and how you came from it, which is why...
I've been fired too.
It really sucks.
But usually if you're getting fired from someplace, it's a good idea for you to be leaving.
Right. And it was. Yeah. I was looking at the time. I knew it wasn't a good fit. But I think things like that, especially for women, can really rattle you. You don't really know where to go. And for people who feel a lot of purpose in their work and a lot of fundamental value out of that, I felt very lost. I felt very scared because financially, I was 25, 24. It was very scary. So I really found out just how amazing my friends are and the network is and how easy it is to just ask for help and reach out when you need it. So
valuable lessons for anybody listening, because no matter what age you are, we all run into the bumps in the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long was it until you landed the next thing?
The summer. So I wouldn't call it fun employment because the anxiety was creeping the whole time. Mm-hmm. But I would say that happened in June and I was employed by August.
And where did you go?
I went to the new media firm.
And is that Will Robinson's firm?
It is.
Oh, a former guest of the show.
And, oh, really?
Yes.
Cool. And
a media consultant of longstanding eminence in the field, sort of.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. Knows a lot about politics. How was that for you?
It was great. Yeah. It's where I really honed in on the advertising side of my career. So I think in the past life, I did a lot of content. I'd done a lot of email writing. And at the time when I was looking at opportunities, I remember looking at roles and thinking, do I want to stay in this email lane? But then there's this ad stuff, which seems really new. There weren't like a ton of places doing it. So it wasn't something where I stumbled across jobs where it was like ads a lot. Whereas you got that with email and social media content. And the ads jobs paid more. And I was like, I like money. So let me go try and build this skill, which I had some access to from a previous role. I knew how to work ads manager. I knew I could figure out Google ads. I like was furiously Googling how to work stuff before my interview. Sorry, Will. Luckily, they believed that I could learn quickly on the job, and I was placing ads shortly thereafter.
And when you say placing ads, for whom and what does that involve?
Yeah, so we had clients who came to us for their overall media strategy. So the new media firm has both television and digital capacity within it. And so I was brought on before the 2014 cycle to really help add capacity for the digital work that we were doing. And so clients come to you with a strategy and a pot of money. They say, here are my goals. What would you do with that money and why? And so it's where I learned a lot about how I think media should work. I don't think it's necessarily complicated. I think it's just there are barriers to information, such as where are people spending their time? What platforms are people using and how? How is the creative that we're using going to be on the platforms? How do we measure success? Which is a huge question across the industry, especially in the persuasion side. I learned everything from writing successful responses for proposal to building out the strategy to financing, figuring out how the budgets worked across the platforms, and also understanding how internally we needed to budget for these things, placing the buys, reporting on them.
Who was a favorite client of yours during that time?
You know, I don't really remember having favorite clients. I remembered having favorite projects. And so we did a couple of projects in New Jersey that I loved because there was just more money. I had more things I was able to do because as with
like
many
New
things.
Jersey unions? Or
it was New Jersey unions.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know how Will feels about sharing clients. So it was a New Jersey labor union that does really big branding campaigns. And so it was great for me to have sometimes seven figures to say, okay, let's, now that we have the budget, let's do some cool measurement and testing around how our ads are actually being received. Are they being recalled? Are people actually leaving with the knowledge that we want them to if they've been exposed to the ad?
And were these both online and TV ads or just one or the other.
I only did online ads.
Yeah.
So the television department, I would say, just knew me as the person who showed up in the 11th hour asking for different sizes and different cuts of things, which I learned really annoys editors.
When you talk to people in the more digital side of the political communication space, they often think that the media consultants that have been around from TV times haven't really adapted fully to communicating over a new medium. Where do you think on that curve was new media for?
Ahead of the curve because they were doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have strong opinions.
Will's always been very interested in new technologies.
Right. And, yeah. But I think in general, the TV ecosystem doesn't lend itself to innovation on digital because it disrupts the financial model they've established, right?
Right.
Digital's cheaper, so it's harder to take a larger commission. Also, digital is different. What we know works on TV, I think, is something that folks have relied on because there's a formula. And if you stick somewhat relatively within the formula, you are more likely to have success. And that doesn't exist in digital yet. I think digital is a medium that really has only existed in its current form, meaning mobile first for a lot of platforms, only in the last year. So we don't have real understandings or true in-depth learnings about if you spend X much on this platform with this frequency, you're going to have these returns in persuasion, especially because people, and when I say people, I mean TV creatives, aren't thinking about how to change the output of their creative to work most for digital. So I think that we have a model of TV consultancies that is fundamentally broken and not designed to innovate for digital. So I would say where I was great because I got to learn how TV consultants think. I got to see how TV ads are made. And I also got to, especially in 2014, which the digital landscape was completely different, learn how to think about placing ads online, because I think the most successful digital strategists don't memorize how a platform works. They kind of take a liberal arts approach and learn how to think about it, and then take the new situations or circumstances and apply them.
So have you kind of developed certain rules of thumb? If you're talking to a candidate for Senate or something, and they asked you, where should my ads be? How would you answer them?
Where the people are spending their time. Yeah.
And where are people spending their time now?
Increasingly on their mobile phone.
Yeah.
And so I also think that's important. It's about time spent, and it's about where people can view most efficiently. So if you're in a rural community that doesn't have like 4G broadband, maybe doubling down on a huge portion of digital ads might not be the best strategy for you. But if you know people are spending time when they open their mail, and you know that they listen to the radio most of the time and they watch their local news, then absolutely place your ads there. That's increasingly not how the American electorate is viewing things. We know that people are spending less time watching commercials. We know that when they are watching television, it's a fragmented experience. People aren't watching broadcasts like they used to. And if they do, it might be TiVo'd. They're not paying attention to the television itself. And we also know that when they are watching TV, a lot of folks are second screening. So they're actually on their phones while they're watching TV. So it makes sense to put your ads where people are, which is their phone.
Can one make a good ad on a small screen like that?
Totally possible.
What constitutes for you good content that will draw the eye of a viewer and get them out to vote or persuade them or whatever you're aiming to do?
Yeah, so I totally have the Facebook mentality because I worked there for a long time and drank the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. I think people have options when they are online, so I think it's important to make sure you capture their attention early, mm-hmm. and not to do so in a shocking or jarring way, but in a way that delights and drives interest. Mm-hmm. It's important to have your brand in the first 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's important to have things captioned because a lot of people are viewing ads without the sound on. So certainly have, you know, pleasant sound if someone decides to turn it on, but your ad should be understandable, mm-hmm. without sound on. And it should be short. Most people aren't going to sit there for like a minute long video or even 30 seconds. If you can, 15 seconds or shorter. And I know the counter narrative is people aren't going to get the full message in 15 seconds, which is why we need to be innovative about how we make creative that engages folks.
So should we produce a version of this podcast, which is just a video that's 30 seconds long?
No, we should do the podcast, and then we could have a lovely ad series, put it on some Instagram stories or Snapchat to get the youngins involved.
I need your help.
We can talk about that later.
Cool.
I'm not a consultant though, so I won't charge you.
Oh, perfect.
Great.
So you were there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was a valuable learning experience to you.
Yeah.
But you moved on. What was next?
I'm now at Acronym.
But you went to Facebook right after. And for how long were you at Facebook?
I was at Facebook for 3 years. So I was at the new media firm for 1 year, and then I was at Facebook for three.
And you're cautious about talking about Facebook, because do they sign you to some vow of silence or what?
No, yeah. I think I, one, would like to be respectful of the company. There's a lot going on there. And while I'm certainly happy to discuss like my perspective and opinions, I'm not a spokesman for the company. And I don't want that to be.
Of course not, especially since you've left.
Right.
And even if I call you Zuckerberg, no one will think that you are the chief spokesperson.
Yeah, this short little black lady is not Mark Zuckerberg over here.
So what was your job there? What was your role?
I was a client solutions manager, which at the time was on the political sales team. Mm-hmm. And so I was responsible for working directly with end clients and the agencies that serve them to help optimize their ad buys, help them understand the platform, do any kind of technical triage. So when things broke, which wasn't not often, being the person who received those notifications and trying to figure out what else worked. And then within that job, I had a lot of opportunity to learn a lot about different facets of the business and different, I guess, sides of the company. So I was able to learn more about how policy works with online companies, learn more about the business side of, at the end of the day, we were essentially running like a little business within. So I learned a lot about revenue pipelines and upselling versus cold selling and consultative selling. I learned a lot because I loved going to trainings. And so I just kind of immersed myself in that whenever I could.
There's a bunch of people that I've crossed paths with that ended up at Facebook that came out of the political space. Is it a political place at all with those, or more generally, or only in this particular subset of the company? What does it feel like over there?
Well, I think the DC office is a political office. There's a reason it's here. Mm-hmm. I also think that Facebook isn't a strong bureaucracy, if that makes sense. There's a lot of intermixing between like levels and also departments. There's a lot of, we would call it cross-functional work that occurs, and political skills are really helpful in that kind of environment. So I think as political practitioners, we're a lot more nimble than the traditional sector. We tend to be a bit more quick. I think we have a stronger capacity for adopting or identifying social norms and reacting to them in a way that I think is helpful in an environment like that. So it doesn't surprise me that a lot of people from the political world end up there just because things move really quickly. It's just a helpful skill set that we have.
Like, how does Facebook intersect with partisanship? Because I know that they've hired people from both parties, and I know that they are obviously taking ads from both parties. Do they separate that out, or do the same people deal with both parties? How is it handled?
It's different. So I can speak to my team. When I was there, we had equal resources and partisanship on each side. It's something we did really deliberately. The Republican teams and the Democratic teams were structured identical, same roles, same access to tools. And we worked very closely to make sure that we, you know, equal access to things. So we did a lot of cross-pollination in terms of what we are going to recommend as the best practice for X, Y, or Z.
What led you to move on from Facebook?
I'd been doing the same thing for 3 years. For me, it just felt like I was out of what I had to give to the space. I had spent all 3 of my years there focusing on the independent expenditure and advocacy space. It's in a space I love. I'm not a campaign person. I really love, one, persuasion and brand campaigns, which is what IEs tend to do more of because they're lasting institutions. I acted a lot as a consultant. And in that time, I think I exhausted my capacity for consulting anymore. I loved the idea of training people, and I loved the capacity of my job where I could help educate buyers as to how to use the platform effectively and watch them grow their careers over time. That I loved. But I just thought it was time to move on, and I was given this amazing opportunity where, what would you like to work on? And I was complaining about how I saw voter registration being executed in the space. And
you're talking about how Acronym courted you, sort of?
Yeah. So it's funny. I used to tell people, like, Mark Zuckerberg is the last white man I'm working for. I'm going to work for myself when I'm done. But there also come across people and thought leaders who really align with how you approach things. And so I had the opportunity to work with Tara when she was at Priorities, and then also as she was starting Lockwood and Acronym. So I was really familiar and very much so bought into this idea of very nimble and thoughtful and innovative creative campaigns to reach people where they are, providing infrastructure in the space so that there isn't this vacuum of information on digital that's being withheld by the consultant class because they need that. So I was already just chatting with her about generally the space. And I had an opportunity to say, hey, like, I'm thinking that about my next steps. What is there?
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, I'm happy to work for a woman in this space. I'll do that.
So you think highly of her?
Yes.
Former guest of the show also.
Yeah.
An impressive young person. What's going on at Acronym? Sounds like she's raised a lot of money. She's got a lot of clients. She's bought some technology. What's going on?
Yeah, we've got a lot of different stuff. So I would say one thing I love is that all of it is mission-driven to be an organization that is progressive, that helps build progressive infrastructure and meets people where they are with innovative campaigns. So we kind of have three different arms, if you will. We have one, which is a tech arm. So what you spoke about, like the technology company, Shadow, so that exists.
I just saw the name of it.
Yeah.
I saw it against the wall. Yeah.
Yep. And so that exists to help provide technological infrastructure and for campaigns. And then we have kind of, I guess, what I would call our campaigns arm. So it's where the program that I am running called People's Power Grab, our voter registration and mobilization programs lives. It's also where our LEDGE programs lives. And our LEDGE program ran its first full cycle in 2018, where we were dedicated to building ad infrastructure for state and local candidate, a space that's been woefully neglected for a variety of reasons. And so, yeah, we're also have a training arm, which is another really important focus. So training people in the movement on digital organizing and relational organizing, how you don't necessarily need to think of digital as buying an expensive tool, although that may work for you, but how you can bring digital tactics into your organizing program just to help make it more efficient and a little bit more modern. And so those are the three things we're up to. It's not small.
How many people work in there now?
I think 30-some. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So kind of burgeoning.
We are.
Yeah.
And one of the new ones as of like 2 months.
Right. You mentioned that your part is called People Power what?
The People's Power Grab. So remember when Mitch McConnell was upset about that very first bill at the House and he said, it's a power grab for the people.
What a terrible thing.
I know. So I figured, why not? If we're going to talk about voter registration and mobilization, I'll just take his lead.
So tell me what you're trying to do there.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about this program because there were a few things that I saw happening in the online voter registration, especially in terms of ads space, mm-hmm. where we have found, or the conventional wisdom is, that online voter registration is most effective when it is deadline-driven and we are driving a sense of urgency. So that's how you get the cheapest, most cost-effective voter registrations online or commitments to vote, however that's being measured. However, there's this whole vacuum of time for about
when
three
it's
and
not
a half
close to
years
a deadline, yeah.
where we don't see folks engaging in online messaging at all. The people who are unregistered, we tend to, I think there's common language in the space that almost demonizes unregistered people to make it almost seem like you have to do this now because you haven't done it before. And I think that that can give receiving audiences a sense of intimidation and also a sense of shame that we're perpetuating from only driving urgency-driven messages to those communities.
It can make someone feel anxiety around registration because it's a scary thing because I haven't done it before.
Yeah.
It should be approached in a softer way with less of a deadline.
Right. Or who is this random person on the internet yelling at me to register to vote? Why is this important that I participate?
Yeah.
People don't participate in the system oftentimes for closely held reasons.
Maybe it doesn't matter that much compared to other things in their life.
Right.
Like eating and getting to work.
Maybe there are institutional barriers. I don't have the day off and I can't take the day off. Maybe it's the fact that they truly don't believe their vote will matter.
Yeah.
I've never seen my government do anything for me, so why should I participate? Or maybe some research shows that people feel anxiety over the fact they don't know enough. They think they have to be the perfect voter with all of this information in order for their vote to matter. So I wanted to design a program where we would deconstruct that over time. And I think the way that we approach voter registration online should mimic the way that we approach buying things in the consumer market, right? We have this marketing funnel that we talk about all the time, mm-hmm. and you don't see that being applied in voter registration. You see it more in a campaign because the phases of a campaign lend themselves to the different phases of the marketing funnel. There's the introduction, there's the consideration persuasion, and then there's GOTV when you have to make a decision, and then the final purchases of vote. We don't do any of the top of the funnel work.
Your theory is there's a ladder of engagement that has to be traversed around voter registration.
Yep, and over time. And it's hard because traditionally investment for this kind of work doesn't come until it's much later. And because the conventional wisdom has been this is how it's most effective, then that's what gets funded. But there hasn't been much innovation in the space in terms of what kinds of messages is it that reaches these non-voters, especially voters of color. There hasn't been, I think, any kind of culturally competent civic engagement work done over a long period of time. And then another huge thing is you don't see much engagement with field groups. There are certain organizations that have done this well. I think NextGen is one of them, where they have a field operation and a digital operation and they are married. But for a lot of organizations that run voter registration, you tend not to see coordination between field groups and the online voter registration ad work that could support each other.
So to what degree are you collaborating with existing groups that do this? And to what degree are you out there on your own?
I have been doing my best to build those relationships in our states. We're working in Arizona, Texas, Florida, and Georgia. And I've done a lot of work meeting with the groups in the field. They know their state better than I do. They understand the non-voters better than I do. They have the local cultural competence, especially if I'm working to register Latinx voters. I'm not Latinx. I don't know a lot of that stuff. So you need to rely on the people there to tell you, this is how our community thinks about these things. This is how our community is approaching this thing. These are the languages in which you need to reach our communities, or the dialects in which you need to reach our communities. And so I want this program to be very intentional and thoughtful about working with partners on the ground in order to drive our information.
So who are you finding as partners? Who have you been meeting with that seems promising as a collaborator?
Yeah, the C3 and C4 tables in Arizona and potentially Georgia. And then we're also working with Forward Florida, Andrew Gillum's group in Florida.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Texas still working on it, but I'm hopeful.
And is Florida, they have passed the bill allowing ex-felons to now vote.
Right.
And there's a big fight still about to what extent that, or to what, whether they're going to have to pay or things like that. What are you seeing happening in Florida?
It seems to me that people of the state wanted to make sure that returning citizens had the right to vote. And the legislature, for whatever reasons, I'm guessing so that they feel like they have a better sense of staying in power, are basically implementing a poll tax to hinder those people from voting. I think that the legislature needs to be more honest about the reasons as to why they want to pass these restrictions. Typically, if you look throughout history, when people are requiring money for you to pay to vote, there is a closely held belief that if you vote, those people may not stay in power. So that's what I see happening there, which I think makes the work all the more critical to make sure that we're expanding the electorate so that they can vote for people who reflect the will of the people.
What kind of resources will you have for this project, and where are they coming from?
We are working on fundraising. So resources, grants, working to get that funding. We don't charge for work. So I think that might be a bit of a misconception. We are a C4. We have Lockwood within acronym. So that allows us the capacity to work across C3, C4 programs, coordinated programs. So we have a lot of flexibility in terms of who we work with, especially as those restrictions vary by state. So we're very deliberate about that. But yes, it is funded through nonprofit work.
I'm not real familiar with it, but I know that there has been work testing different strategies for voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen in the research there?
I think one thing that's fairly consistent is we know social pressure works, but I think a lot of my questions and a lot of the work that exists in voter registration world is that the tests that have been done on digital haven't been done in a modern context, which gives me a lot of pause to say this is what we know works and why I think there's a lot of testing and innovation that we need to do to help drive that narrative. So if you think about tests that were run in 2014 and 2015, how people were consuming digital was very different. People were on their desktops probably more than their cell phones. Most people couldn't watch a full video on their cell phones. The way that Facebook was operating at the time, I remember getting the capacity to place video ads during the 2014 cycle. People were mainly relying on YouTube or Google networks for video, and people were mostly consuming social media in text and photo. And so now we're in an ecosystem where video is surpassing photo content in terms of time spent with on a lot of platforms. And the way that people construct their ads has a much larger impact on how you buy them, I think. And so I think we need to do more research to understand what works. And my hunch is when you run more educational content ahead of a direct response ask or a pledge to vote, I think you're going to see the cost of the pledge or the direct response ask go down. I think you're going to see more voter registrations overall. And I think you're also going to see more people mobilized because you would have overcome the hurdle of the civic participation gap. So people who register to vote would be more likely to follow through with the actual voting. That's just my hunch and what I'm hoping to test over the next cycle.
Well, yeah, you're talking about testing and innovation and how are you going to embed that in what you're doing? How are you going to wire that into the program?
I think it's being really deliberate about it from the get-go. So when I think about programs and how they run, I don't like to use conventionally held wisdom to say this is how it works. If someone's going to say that deadline-driven messaging only works with no content up front, I need to see a study that says that. And if not, I want to be the one to provide it. So when we think about our content and we think about how we're designing programs, building testing into that component, and the thing is, it's really hard work. I don't want to make it seem like it's easier that we have all the answers. I think there are trade-offs you need to make in terms of the methodology that you use. I think there are trade-offs you need to make in terms of costs, even sometimes, in terms of what strategies you're going to operate on. And so I think the key is being transparent about those decisions you're making, being transparent about, you know, maybe it's shortcoming with data, maybe it is the difficulty of matching back to the voter file, maybe it's sacrificing scale for running a test that you know you can have a randomized test control environment, even though you're going to have a smaller data set because you need one-to-one matching with your data. There are a whole host of considerations. And so I think it's better to have imperfect measurement or as close to perfect as you can get while acknowledging all of the different things and the decisions that you made and the shortcomings and the trade-offs than having nothing at all or running with this idea of we know what works when the media landscape's so different from last cycle.
If you had your kind of your dreams realized with this program and it went as you really would love, what would it look like? What would you find? What would happen?
I think every state would have this really harmonious and fluid voter registration table with the field that closely coordinated with us to help us understand who they're talking to. I think it would be super easy and really cheap to measure different tactics in terms of being able to easily design a test where I could understand if we had a touch in the field, and then this specific individual received three impressions from one platform and two from another in 2 weeks, whether or not that had an impact on the cost of the voter registration that came back in the field. I think that privacy laws will never allow that to happen. But we would have a robust set of learnings that would help us understand what kinds of content motivate different segments of people to register to vote and to mobilize. At the end of the day, we would be able to understand how field and digital ads could coordinate in a way, and also organic impressions too, could coordinate in a way to drive down costs for both field programs and online voter registration programs. We'd be able to adopt this model and have everyone in the world understand how it works so we could mobilize all the Democratic or progressive voters in the space so that we finally turn our country blue and reflect the will of the people who don't vote as well as the people who do.
Well, let's hope that all happens.
God willing, I'll try.
One of the big frustrations, as you're well aware, with voter registration is that while you're out there trying to register voters, there are other people trying to unregister them.
Yeah.
There are other people in Georgia. That right now, they're trying to even make it illegal to have voter registration in Tennessee, like to have movements to do it.
Same things happened in Texas.
Yeah. Is the knowledge of that that's going on, how does that play into your planning?
The way that I've thought about this is that I don't think that I'm in a space with the knowledge or relationships to tackle that head on, but I know that there are organizations who are working on that. So think about a Reclaim the Vote that's working on ways to inform people of when they've come off the voter rolls, and a Spread the Vote that's working to combat voter ID laws. And so over time, thinking if there's a way for us to support those efforts or provide information or knowledge, more than happy to do it. But just being a champion for the organizations that already exist that do the work, because I don't think ads can solve everything. And I don't think that systemic voter disenfranchisement is one of those things that ads can fix.
Are there other things about the campaign arm of Acronym that are worth talking about?
I think our state legislative work is pretty cool. I think we saw state legislative candidates really have an opportunity through the Ledge program to have digital infrastructure in a way that hasn't really existed. I think because of how the ecosystem, particularly around advertisements, operates, it's hard for state Ledge candidates to afford an agency. Agencies tend to hold information about how to run ad programs in silos, and it's hard to access people at the platforms at that level because over time the spend wasn't big enough. So there really is a compounding of lack of information. And so the fact that we were able to help provide online support to drive positive message ID and understand how contrast messaging can work at the local level was really awesome. And I'm excited about the work that we're doing in Virginia this cycle as well.
You know, one of the things that you've mentioned a couple times is the word transparency. Mm-hmm. And there have been some efforts that have come to my attention and probably others that I've missed out of Acronym to sort of share information about what's going on in the digital space. Can you talk about a few of those?
Sure. I think our trainings are something I'm really proud of our organization for doing and shedding a light on. So providing information about what digital is, like how you can become a practitioner working with the arena to work on their digital director track and build knowledge with folks who really want it and want to be on campaigns and thinking through how we can share that information knowledge. I think also just pushing and being thought leaders in this space has helped elevate, I think, the conversation. So I think it's helpful for all industries who might be in the same habit to have a voice that's outside of that industry a bit pushing has been good.
Haven't there also been some sort of dashboards of information released about like who's spending what or what's happening among the tech tools?
Yes, and, for what it's worth. So For What It's Worth is our weekly newsletter, and it's great. We track a lot of the spending that's been happening through using the Facebook and Google platforms. We talk about the trends that we're seeing week over week in terms of spend, and then also things that may be topical of that week. So for instance, when the FEC reports came out, we did a bit of a deep dive in where campaigns are spending their money on digital tech. Yeah. So every week has a different topic. And we also just released a dashboard. So using the Facebook API to reveal where people are spending their money, which campaigns are spending and how.
So this sounds like a fun job for you.
It's really fun.
You said you're... Maybe before we started talking, but you said this is you're kind of in the honeymoon period.
Yeah. Right?
What is it about this work that seems like ultimately such a good fit?
I think it's a good fit for a few reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, bureaucracies aren't my thing. I'm really not good at them. I don't thrive in them. And this is not that. I also think it's been an opportunity. I saw a lot of campaigns in my last job. And not to impugn the work of anyone at all. However, when you look at a lot of people's work, you begin to develop strong opinions about what you think should be happening in the space. And I have this amazing opportunity to drive learnings and innovation in a way that I think has been missing and in a way that I think is really congruent with the mission of our organization, which is really exciting. I'm also really excited not to be an ads manager every day. I did that for about 5 years. And I don't know if you've ever been in there, but like the gray and the blue can begin to like blur together in a way that I'm really excited I don't have to look at every day.
Well, change is good, isn't it? And growth is good.
It is good. So yeah, it's exciting. And it's a leadership position that I haven't been able to have at any other organization. So it's exciting to, you know, not just train people, but to really think about and working with a team of people I hope to positively impact in the way that my great managers have in my life too.
And if you raise money for this, you'll probably be able to hire staff and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep me in mind. What question have I failed to ask that I should have?
I don't know. I really liked all of these questions.
One of the things about working with people years ago and then connecting with them again is just so wonderful to see the development and the progress that people make in their careers and to see them land in a place that makes them happy and is making a difference in the world.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited. I like the idea of expanding the electorate, so yep. I'm ready to go.
All right. Well, thank you. It's been an honor. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you for having me. This has been a treat.
Thanks, Tatenda. That was Tatenda at Acronym. I hope that Tatenda is really onto something in the voter reg space. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.